You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner Kent, Editor-in-Chief, American Theater. I'm here with
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And Allison Considine, the Editorial Assistant.
Welcome, Allison. I think this is your first podcast with us, right? I
mean, this is.
Oh, and speaking of first, it's Rob's first time introducing himself as the editor in chief
of
American
right.
Theater. How does it feel?
It feels all different. It feels different. I feel the weight of the world on my shoulders. No, I think it's been good. It's been good. It's actually an interesting time. We're sort of Jim O'Quinn, my predecessor, is also still editor in chief. We're kind of both at the same time in a transition here. A little bit like a super fast, unfamily-related version of what Penumbra Theater does, is doing with Lou and Sarah Bellamy, where they're, the transition is happening. But that's happening over like a period of years. With Jim, it's a period of a month or month and change. So,
I'm telling everyone I have two bosses right now, and I don't know who to listen to.
Just listen to me. No, you listen to, we give Jim utmost respect. He's done this job for 32 years more. And so it's moving to New Orleans. But you can read all about that if you want. We wrote about Jim's announcing his departure some months ago. And I'm sure we will write a little bit more about
Or get him on here.
Get him on for an exit interview, exactly. Yep. And he's also going to keep writing for us. He's moved to New Orleans, where he has a home and he has lived part-time, and he's from near that area. Louisiana, and he'll still be an active correspondent for American Theater. He's still vigorous. He's just moving on to another chapter. So in any case, speaking of other chapters, that's not much of a segue. We were a little late with this episode because our podcast Empress Deep was out of town last week. And where were you, Deep?
I spent 2 weeks at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in beautiful Waterford, Connecticut, doing the National Critics Institute, which is run by Chris Jones of the Chicago Tribune. I was drinking with Chris and like 13 other critics for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
Sounds good.
Relaxing. I stayed in a little pink cottage named August Wilson. It's like they knew I was coming when they put me in there.
Uh-huh.
And I saw four or five. I don't remember how many readings I saw of like works that are in progress at the Eugene O'Neill Center. I saw the new musical by Greg Kotis and Mark Holman of Urinetown fame. Mm-hmm. It's called ZM. I think they might be changing it. Which ZM stands
for zombies, right?
Zombie musical. In case for the people who don't know what they're going to be walking into, it's they put it right out there.
Right. Okay.
And it was actually really fun. I had a great time watching it because it was the very first time they were reading it in front of an audience. Uh-huh. And that morning, Greg and Mark had rewritten Act Two, so that was the first time that they were reading Act Two publicly.
Right.
And he'd also written a new song, and they hadn't rehearsed it yet. So at the end, Mark came out in a piano with a piano accompaniment, and he sang the song, which was a little bit too high for him, but it worked out. And his son was in the show.
Wow.
I'm very excited to see where that musical goes. And
so there were songs about eating brains or songs accompanying the eating of brains?
There were zombie songs, zombie monologue songs. Like, it's the first time we've ever gotten to like see what a zombie is thinking. And apparently when zombies think, they think in show tunes.
Wow. Do they sound articulate?
Yes, okay. And then there's supposed to be a zombie dream ballet,
right,
in future iterations.
Well, there was a musical of the Night of the Living Dead, but it was at New Line Theater in St. Louis, but it had no zombies in it. It was all about the people in the room. I mean, it had zombies in it, but I don't think the zombies sang. And it was a serious musical too. So
I would be very sad if I expected to see zombies in the musical and I did not get zombies.
Right.
But no,
right.
The opening image is a zombie eating someone, and there's blood and guts and innards. All
of course,
great
this is all
musical
described in a reading.
Yeah,
right? Now, let me ask you something.
Via the stage directions.
Now, you see these readings and a couple other things. You went to
I went to the new Steven Sater.
The new Steven Sater.
Sater play.
Where was that?
No One Sonata. And I also saw this really fantastic, still needs a little work. It's called Leftovers. Leftover. I think singular. I have to check. And it's by this up-and-coming playwright named Josh Wilder. He's African-American. He's currently at Yale getting his MFA. And Kelly Miller, who's a former literary manager of South Coast Rep, was a dramaturg for it.
Okay.
And it's a magical realism exploration of growing up as an African-American young man in Philadelphia. And in the first scene, a giant beanstalk-like dandelion pops up from the sidewalk. So it's not your typical exploration of inner city life. And it's really funny. And there's some Cosby Show references, which is slightly problematic, but I think he's going to fix it in future iterations.
Right. It might have been written before.
Yeah, it was definitely written before all that stuff broke.
Right. Right.
So, and then...
Now, you're not supposed to review these shows, right?
No.
Or you write reviews as part of the Institute, but then they're never made public, right? They're just internally critiqued and, shared.
Yeah, I wrote 10 reviews in 2 weeks, and so by the time I left, I could not coherently form sentences.
Right.
I'm better this week.
So now, you saw those 4 or 5 show readings at the O'Neill, but there were other performances you saw while you were in the region. Is that right?
Yes, I was in the region. I went to the Goodspeed for the very first time.
Okay.
And then a picturesque little theater next to, I forget, the Colorado, which river?
I don't know, but isn't it?
It's next to water.
It's East Haddam, Connecticut.
Yes.
Is that right? I know because from entering listings of like, I've learned all these fall names, Watertown, East Haddam, you know. So... It's not Watertown, is it? Is it
Watertown? East Haddam.
Yeah, anyway, go on.
Connecticut. And then I went to Jacob's Pillow for the first time. That was super exciting. It was a 2.5-hour van ride from the Eugene O'Neill Center.
Right.
And it was also like the Eugene O'Neill Center is like in the middle of nowhere. It's next to the ocean and there's a private beach and you can just, ride outside or right on the porch in rocking chairs. And Jacob's Pillow was in the same vein. It was also very much in nature in the mountains but bigger. So there's more buildings, there's more houses, there's more stages.
Okay.
And there's this beautiful outdoor stage with the trees in the background and there's trees overhanging the stage and so you get this beautiful play of shadow and light as you're watching a performance. So that was really nice.
That's nice.
And we saw Netherlands Dance Theater, which is one of the best modern dance troupes in the world. Right. And we were supposed to write about dance.
Right.
And I've never written about dance. So it was a lot of words about undulating bodies. And
Yeah, I'm sure. Just as when I know that when I would when I was reviewing, and you have to come up with ways to remember to mention the lighting and to mention the sets. And there would be this handful of adjectives that you would use for lights, crepuscular or twilight or set design would often be resourceful set by, these cliches. I'm sure with dance, there's a lot of cliches that people, I don't know if did they, when you're about to go review these things, you did some food reviews too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we did food reviews. Sam Sifton of the New York Times read our food reviews.
Yeah.
Yeah, he
now,
enjoyed it.
Before you do it, do they sort of warn you there's these cliches you might want to avoid? Or is it more like they just look at, this is a cliche about, spicy food or?
It was more like before we did it, they went over the form of how to do it. And, of course, Sam did say don't use the word foodie because he hates that word.
Fruity?
Foodie.
Okay. He hates that word. Okay, well, that's good that he made his biases clear up front.
There was something Chris told us on the first day, which is actors hate it when you use one adjective to describe their performance,
like
the spectacular.
And yet critics often take the time to, like, when they just have nothing but parentheses to say so-and-so, to, like, they'll just they labor to come up, like, the sensational or try to come up with something more than that,
Or, like, the solid.
Or the avuncular is another favorite word.
But I'm thinking you have to really earn a full sentence, though.
Right. Would they prefer having no adjective?
I have no idea.
I'm sure that, actors can remember. They remember what you've written about them, like, and quote it back to you. I've had that happen, certainly.
Mm-hmm. It was great, though. Like, I had, both Greg and Josh, came up to me and asked what I thought of their work, and it was like a little critiquing session, which was really interesting. So,
you mean Greg Kotis?
Yeah, Greg Kotis and Josh Wilder, whose plays I both saw, and so it's like a very
collegial.
Yeah, collegial atmosphere.
So now, would you, when a playwright asks you, I mean, the myth I've heard about, for say, London critics, is that you can go out for them for a drink afterwards, and they'll tell you what they think. If they have a pint in their hand, they'll say, "Oh, this really is, you know, it's crap," or it's "this is good, this is bad," and you should fire that actor, whatever. The critics, supposedly, that's the myth I've heard, that they'll just tell you what they think, and of course, this is before they've gone home to write the review or after. I don't know.
How do they do it? They still have like overnight reviews.
Right? Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that's a myth I've heard. So when a playwright comes up to you, this is a rare thing for them to come up to a member of the press and go, "So what do you think?" Of course, I've often had conversations with playwrights where it's clear that that's what they want. That's what they want to know, but they won't come out and ask and say, "What do you think?" You know. Mm-hmm. Do you feel empowered just to be honest and say, "Well, that part, you know."
Yeah.
Or do you just say nice things only?
Oh no! Josh came up to me and he's like, "What do you think?" I'm like, "Honestly." And I basically said, first act is perfect, second act needs work, you have to address the Bill Cosby thing, all that good stuff.
Right, right. Okay.
Of course, caveat, that doesn't mean that no one should be producing this play. Someone should be producing his play because it is a really great play.
But now you're supposed to say that?
No, I just really think that it's a really good play that should have a life somewhere.
Right, right.
Because he's up and coming.
Without naming names, if there's anybody whose play you didn't like, if they came up to you and said, "What'd you think of my play?" You would say... what I usually say is congratulations, or my favorite thing, just as I say, I had fun, which could mean I had fun thinking about something else. I had fun looking at the sunset. I had, you know, or I enjoyed myself. I'll say that. I enjoyed myself. I didn't enjoy your play. I enjoyed myself. Yeah.
But what if you didn't enjoy yourself? Because there was something, I have seen things where I did not have a good time.
Well, you know, it's about the best thing I can say. And, you know, there is a sort of etiquette about just right in the midst of a show when it's on. There's that famous story of Sondheim and Jason Robert Brown. You remember that story? You heard that story where Jason Robert Brown went to go see one of Sondheim's show, he wouldn't say which one it was, and afterwards they went out for drinks. It was Jason Robert Brown and another friend and Sondheim. Mm-hmm. And Jason Robert Brown did not say anything about the show because he didn't like it. And Sondheim could tell.
Which show?
He wouldn't say. I think it was Passion, but Jason Robert Brown has denied this. Anyway, you can look it up. You can look it up.
Really?
It's a great blog post in which Jason Robert Brown realizes that he should have just lied and said, "You know, great show, really enjoyed it, tell me more about it." Because it was previews, it was still very raw. And, you know, Sondheim is not someone who is shy about making criticism himself and seems like pretty thick-skinned. But his point was, like, in the moment when you're putting on a show, the artist wants to hear, maybe not in a workshop thing where they really are trying to work on it.
Yeah.
But when it's up on Broadway and it's after a show, they want to hear just, like, great job. And apparently, and I've been in the situation, too, where I've gone out with someone afterwards and have studiously avoided talking about it because it was bad or I didn't like it. I don't want the subject to come up. And they can tell. The reason you're not talking about it is because you didn't want to talk about it. Anyway, that's a digression.
I've never had that happen to me where I've hung out with artists after a show that I didn't like.
It's rare.
Yeah.
But it happens.
Again, my friends only write good plays.
Sure. And if you have enough to drink, it'll seem even better in memory, right?
I nap these days. If I have a drink before shows, I fall asleep.
Not before. I'm talking after.
During the show?
I'm talking after.
Yeah, I can't help it sometimes.
What about during a show? I think more alcohol should be served during shows.
I think so. Drinks at intermission.
Yeah. Drinks at intermission, or if you can take a beer into the theater, that's the ideal.
Well, some theaters, you can pre-order a drink beforehand, and then
that's
they'll serve it to you at intermission.
I've London, that's a very big thing.
Yes.
So pick up your drink you pre-ordered and have your
London,
pint of
can you take your drink
ice cream.
To the seat in London? I know that you can take your ice cream, that weird little package.
The little Haagen-Dazs.
Right, exactly, to the seat.
Wait, they have ice cream in London?
They do.
Yes,
I thought it was like maybe a one-off at one of the theaters, it was pretty consistent.
Man, one more reason for me to go to the theater in London.
Right, and you know, we want to talk about your trip to the Contemporary American Theater Festival. That's in
Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
Sorry, yes.
Which is believed to be the oldest town in the state.
In the state of West Virginia.
In the state of West Virginia. So it's really interesting then to have these brand new contemporary plays. They're very avant-garde in this very old town in West Virginia, kind of in the middle of nowhere. So,
we're both in the nature these past weeks. Right, right.
You're both in nature, which is nice. I kept going back to this while, as I was talking to the playwrights and a lot of people involved in the festival, how nice it must be to create theater in a place like that.
Yeah.
But it's also such a great environment to see theater, you know, to walk out of the theater and, I don't know, this one night there was fireflies everywhere and everyone was just sitting around and talking about the shows that they had all just seen. So it's a very special place. The festival's been going on for 25 years. So it started in 1991. So it was interesting to see how many people had been coming back year after year to this festival. Everyone was wearing these buttons that said the year that they had started coming. And
oh, really?
There's a lot of folks walking around with 1991 or 92 buttons, and they've come all the years subsequent to that. So it was great to see this community that they had built. And Ed Herendeen, the artistic director, has really kind of cultivated this community where these people crave these really edgy, provocative contemporary plays. And it's interesting that this is all taking place where it is.
Mm-hmm.
So there was five plays that were featured, and the festival set up in a nice way where you can see all of the plays in a weekend. So I did that. It was quite a whirlwind, but it is nice for out of towners to come in and be able to see the whole festival in that amount of time. So I saw Everything You Touch, which has had previous productions before.
Yeah. Sheila Callahan's play, right?
Yeah. Sheila Callahan. And World Builders, which was a world premiere by Jonna Adams. We Are Pussy Riot by Barbara Hammond. And On Clover Road by Stephen Dietz. And The Full Catastrophe by Michael Weller. So they were all kind of
That's quite a range of playwrights, too. But ones who've been, like a Michael Weller's been doing it for, you know, as long as I've been alive, basically.
Right.
You know, and
Jonna Adams been produced there, too.
And Jonna, she has.
Yeah, Gideon's
new.
Not.
And then, of course... So what was your impression of what are these are stage readings or just readings at music stands?
No, I was shocked because that is what I expected. These were full productions.
Wow.
It was incredible. Yeah. They had three spaces.
Yeah.
It's a full season. It's interesting because...
So it's like Humana in a way. It's brand new plays, fully produced.
In a month, right? Is it...
Yes. Okay. So I think they started like the first week of June.
Wow, I didn't even know that.
It's
Why did I not know that?
Crazy because they have three spaces they use and everything's in rep. So they have these fully staged productions and two of the theaters share the space. So in the afternoon they have one show and have to take everything out and rebuild the set for the second show. And it really is a lot more than I thought. I really was expecting music stands.
Right,
But they treat it as if they're still in that stage. Like they are very much... still looking for audience feedback. And
right.
I know Barbara Hammond was workshopping up until it was put on. And right. she's hoping the next iteration will be a little bit different than what had gone on at CATF. But I think Stephen Dietz put it in a way. He said these plays are fluid, not solid.
That's
that was a good phrase.
Interesting.
And speaking with a lot of the playwrights, I know Jonna said that she feels like this was her last go at it. She's not sure how many more corrections she'll make to her draft. And I think that was kind of the same case with a lot of writers. Like after this experience of working, I think they arrive the first week of June, most of them, if they even get a chance to be at the festival. But they just go through this process of working on them. And then once they're staged, they're at this point where they feel like it's ready for its next leg elsewhere.
And do you get the sense of a lot of people there from the field looking for plays and place to publish, place to produce?
You know, it was press weekend.
Industry weekend.
There were
as
a
much.
Few people around, but on the whole, I didn't get that sense. I thought there'd be more people lurking around.
Like looking lit for, agents. Yeah, like talent spotting, right?
Yeah. But I know that Michael Weller's play, The Full Catastrophe, there was a producer there that is already interested in putting it up. I'm not sure what its next iteration will be. Mm-hmm. But World Builders, Jonna Adams has two out of three theaters signed on to do a new play, national rolling premiere.
I just figured out where these are in the life of the play. It sounds like O'Neill, it's very early in the life of the play.
Oh, yeah, definitely. For the O'Neill, it runs the gamut from, like, this is the first time we're putting it up in front of any audience, and this end to this is the second or third reading this play has had.
Right.
So... Mm-hmm. but still very much in development, and not all the plays have homes yet.
Right, and the CATF sounds like it's near the end of that development cycle, and it's ready to have further productions. I mean, that's, if a further production gets put up and the playwrights are around, they probably would be doing tweaks, but it sounds, right. It sounds like big developmental work would be done on these
plays after. It seems like a lot. I was talking to Barbara Hammond, and she said that the design team and everybody at CATF received her script, or at least a version of it, in December and started planning and designing and working on it up until when she arrived in June. So she was kind of surprised at how, just the spirit of everybody at the festival who was on board and willing to bring to life her script. So it seems like the development process has been going on for a couple of months.
That's great. So you'll be writing a story for online about CATF, and I think we've decided you're going to write something about the O'Neill. Is that right?
If time allows. If time depends permits. On when you want it, Rob.
If time permits. Well, we've got all the time in the world. I would just encourage readers to check out, we've been trying, since we have the website, to cover as many of these new play festivals as possible. Everything from the Denver Center's Summit to the Nashville Rep's Ingram New Works, and Humana and Pacific Playwrights.
And all the fringes.
It's like as many of the fringes as we can as well.
We're full of fringe this summer.
We're trying to trying to wear the fringe. so that's a good, great report. We're about to go to an interview with Che Yu, the Arts Director of Victory Gardens Theater, which I recorded at the TCG conference. But first, a little chat about everyone's favorite topic, cell phone etiquette or cell phone bad behavior. Obviously, it's been a hot topic with the idiot who plugged his iPhone into or tried to plug his iPhone into what looked like a working outlet on the set of Hand to God. And Patti LuPone being sort of a hero of the theater for confiscating someone's cell phone and being when they were texting in the front row.
Jonathan Groff called Madonna a bitch for for being on the phone during Hamilton.
Yeah, well, apparently I didn't realize that Lin-Manuel Miranda banned her from backstage as a result. He would not confirm himself that it was her, but everyone said it was her. She was texting through the second act. You could see her I wrote a piece about this in which I tried to lower the temperature a little bit of the complaints, just because I feel like there's some people who talk about it as if the way they talk about it, it's understandable. They talk about any sort of threat to the theater, like audiences are getting too old or theater's not diverse enough. And all these are real concerns. I'm not dismissing them. This is a real concern. People are doing their cell phones way too much in the theater. We all walk in. All of us walk in. Like, I don't think there's almost no one who walks in who does not have a device in their pocket. And theaters are having to deal with this new crisis. I'm just saying the theater has survived, the Elizabethan groundlings. It survived the Astor Place riots in which people were fighting, killing each other over which Macbeth they liked the best. Or was it Hamlet? I forget which. I think it was Macbeth. They've survived vegetables being thrown on stage. I think the theater is not in danger. It's just like, what is the social contract we're gonna have in the theater right now? Is it church, or is it something a little more social? I haven't had that many experiences where I felt like I just can't do this anymore. This is terrible. Everyone around me is an asshole and with a cell phone. I've had a few experiences where people text next to me, where I've wanted to throw it across the room. There was one of my favorite stories was that one from Natasha Pierre where that guy took a woman's cell phone and threw it.
Yeah.
It was a little unsafe, to do that in a theater where
it was a tent because it was a tent. And so
you could hit an actor. Yeah. He didn't even know where it went. It was like went into some offstage curtain area and it could have hit an actor. But, I think in general, I don't want to be too laissez-faire about it, but I kind of feel like I'm all for, more shaming of people's behavior, just because I think shame is a useful way to do this as a sort of social policing of each other, right? Like, theaters can come up with policies, but we should police each other as much as possible. In much of the way people talk about, people shouldn't be censored from saying stupid things, right? Mm-hmm. But they should, if they say stupid things, if people
send guidelines,
draw silly cartoons of Muhammad or burn the Quran, well, no, they shouldn't be banned from doing that. But of course, they should be mocked and deplored for it. So we should mock people who do this ridiculous behavior in the theater.
Well, that's a good thing about social media, and anyone can be subject to very, very public shaming.
Right. I mean, up to a point. I mean, I'm not in favor of shame of everything, but yeah, I think, in other words, I'm saying we have social mechanisms which are in place which will help us to deal with this. We don't have to wring our hands too much and say, oh my God, the heathens in the theater who are ruining our experience. I mean, I don't want to hog them
mic here. Yeah, there's not that many heathens, though. It's a very handful of times that this stuff has gotten into the mainstream news, and it's a very handful of times that a cell phone has actually gone off in the theater when I have been in it. I go to the
really?
Theater
only
two,
a handful?
Three,
I would
three
say,
times
I would
a week.
Say, I would say I hear ringtones in about half the performances mm-hmm. I go to. Just here and there. Nothing.
Yeah, it's a ringtone, then people turn it off. It's not, but I've never actually, I've rarely seen the occasion of people like actively texting and photographing during a show.
Right,
granted,
right.
I was at the Goodspeed and someone was actively taking video during the performance.
That's not cool.
That is very not cool, and that is very illegal. But at the same time, is it the end of theater as we know it?
No.
Not really. We're trying to wean people off of devices that they have with them all the time, that they use all the time, even during dinner when they're supposed to be talking to other people.
Yeah.
So if your friend can't grab your attention during dinner when you actually like that person across from you, then how is Patti LuPone or Lin-Manuel supposed to do it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like it's actually in some ways the trend has gotten better in that there are more people who know how to turn off their phones, and it's been ingrained so much. I remember the worst experiences I've ever had in the theater with cell phone ringtones was a couple of years ago, like 5-10 years ago, when I don't mean to disparage older people, but it was the kind of thing where people didn't know how to turn off their phones, and they had loud ringtones, and it was the Vanessa Redgrave at the Year of Magical Thinking when she got to the most intense part about Joan Didion's daughter's death. This cell phone would not go off. And it was like inflicting another grief on this poor character. She's lost two people in her life, and this woman's cell phone will not go off. But I feel like that wouldn't happen today. That woman, I don't know, people wouldn't have their cell... People know how to use this technology. But, you know, I do feel like... Alfred Molina posted something on Facebook in which he feels like it's just become so rampant. It used to be rare, and now it's rampant. And I don't know, I haven't experienced it as much.
It used to be rare because people's cell phones didn't connect to Facebook back in the day.
Well, I suppose.
I went to a seminar where Bryan Cranston was talking about his performance in All the Way.
Yeah.
And it was hysterical because he'd say he'd see the people in the first row with their faces lit up with their cell phone. So he would change the blocking in a way that when he would get really... he'd get so angry and he would change the blocking and make sure that his spit would hit the people in the front row who were on their phone. And I love that because it was like his own way of policing this
I'm
issue
all in favor of shame and more shame and spit.
And more spitting,
more
on,
spitting
the
on the audience. I think that's... I mean, you know, the main point is that we're theater's always been around people. And that's what it is. It's not a private, unless it's a theater for one thing. It's not a private experience. And even then, there's a person on stage. You're sharing the space with a lot of humanity. And, you know, these problems of the way humans behave range pretty widely. And cell phones are something, as you pointed out, Deep, that we have to deal with in all of our, like, it's
exactly.
a social problem in all of
exactly.
our behavior. In our personal relationships with each other, over dinner, at home.
At
kids.
At the movies.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a problem that we have to address as a society.
I hope so.
It's not just theater's problem. It's everybody's
right.
problem.
It's all of our problems. That's great. Mm-hmm. There's no graceful segue from that to Che Yu. But Che Yu is a wonderful playwright director who happens to run a theater. He's one of the few playwrights who runs a theater, Kwame Kwe Arma and Emily Mann being two others. But he runs a theater, Victory Gardens, in Chicago. I go back some way with Che, used to follow his work in Los Angeles when he was there, when he was with the Tapers writing lab, and he did a wonderful cycle of plays and repertory at East West Players. And I've just kept up with him over the years, and we sat down and spoke about his career, about Chicago, about King and I, and other exciting things at the TCG conference. So here's my interview with Che.
Thank you. So I'm here with Chae Yu. We go back a long way.
Yes.
And we're not going to say how long.
No.
Yes, and that you're running Victory Gardens. It's been, what, 2 or 3 years now?
4 years.
Four years already. Oh, my gosh. Time flies.
Yeah, it has.
And how has it been?
It's been good. You know, a great transition, not without a lot of complications, difficulties, and triumphs. Being impatient, obviously you want it to happen faster than you like it to.
Right.
There's always a little, I think, scheduling situation.
Sure,
with how things turn out the way they do.
Right.
So it's been good so far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a dumb question I wanted to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about the name, Victory Gardens. Is that a wartime reference?
It is. It's about the gardens. And then I think there's a wonderful metaphor when the founding, I would say, ensemble that came together, they felt like this was the place where they will grow plays. They will grow Chicago artists.
Huh.
Yeah.
You know, I always wondered about that name. It's a kind of a glorious but confusing
name. Yes, it is.
Name, Victory Gardens.
Had no idea what it meant until I had to look it up from Google. You know?
Right, look up Victory Gardens. Okay. And I think when we ran into each other recently, mm-hmm. before the King and I at Lincoln Center, so I didn't hear what you thought about it, so you can tell me that, either on or off the record. We can talk about that in a second. But you were mentioning about some of the challenges of the audience, I think, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the subscribers? Or maybe the neighborhood. You tell me about, I think you said, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but that your experience was that Chicago's very segregated.
Yes, it's very, very racially segregated. Yeah, one of the most in the country.
Yeah.
Right.
And where, Victory Gardens, what neighborhood is that in?
It's in Lincoln Park, just a bit north from the Loop. Loop is where the downtown area is. So anything above the Loop tends to be white.
Right.
And then you go west and south, you get more African Americans living there, and a huge Latino community on the west side of it.
Pilsen, right?
Pilsen and the village. Right. That's correct.
Right. And so where does Victory Gardens fit into that world? You said it's in a sort of more white area.
I think Victory Gardens has always had the reputation of doing new work and diversity. So it's that theater company that does work, which is outside, I would say, the cultural realm of its neighbors.
Okay.
So it's always had that history. And I think when I came on, my question was, how do we amplify what we do? So the notion of making a 2.0 version of the theater became crucial. So who are the new playwrights of color? What are they trying to say next?
Right.
So we're bringing all these voices into our theater. And some of our audiences, I have to say, are actually on the ride. And some have actually said, I don't think this is right for me anymore.
Okay.
You know, and I've also experiences where people are saying things to me, oh, my God, I mean, isn't this race thing over yet? You know,
did we already do that?
Yeah, right. Did we do that? And I think it's very interesting. So when they're saying this to the talkbacks, we have one every night, across the aisle, some other younger people, and it could be even white, saying, no, we're not done yet. So what I've actually, I would say, inadvertently succeeded is I have the face of Chicago in my theater.
Right.
And it's basically something that we have to create in terms of a dialogue between all the segregated communities about race, about class, about all the issues. So I think in a wonderful way, even though they're all these contradictory points of view, I'm glad we have them in the theater. And it's complicated because I'm not going to shy away, but meanwhile, you know, some subscribers, God bless them, they will say what they want to say, but yet we see them again next year.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether also, having spoken to some of them, you know, they fought so hard in the 60s for civil rights.
Then
next thing you know, with things happening in Ferguson, they just realized they've, instead of moving a mile, they've moved an inch.
Yeah. How would you compare? I spent a lot of time in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
and New York as well. How would you compare the audiences in Chicago?
I actually love Chicago audiences because they're probably the most engaged, and also they go to theater quite a bit. I don't know why that is.
Yeah.
I meet a regular theater goer and on off night, and we will say hello, and then they will tell me what four shows they've seen during the week, and they range from the big theaters to the small theaters.
Yeah.
And they see everything. They tend to be very knowledgeable, and the talkbacks have been great too because they actually don't talk about the play and its construction, to talk about the issues. I wonder if it's a cultural Midwestern thing, actually, the relationship to theater and storytelling.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's been actually very interesting. We have topics every night, and what happens is the audience actually raises interesting questions, and they actually, I would say, are self-reflective in an interesting sort of way, and also it's a city that loves civic service, and also, I would say, volunteerism. So the question is, how do we spark that? The social justice thing is fascinating to me. That's the one thing that keeps me going in Chicago.
the social justice side.
I think there's a want and a desire for change. And then my question is, how does theater fit in all of this? How did it become a catalyst?
Right. What in the past season, what was one of the shows that caused the most?
I think it was Marcus Gardley's play, An Issue of Blood. He was going to write a play for us called A Wonder in My Soul about the Great Migration. Okay. Then December hit, and then it was all about Ferguson. The verdicts came out. Everyone's not guilty, and of course, we responded quickly with a one night only event with a bunch of playwrights and poets responding to it called We Must Breathe, and Marcus contributed a piece, but he couldn't write his new play. So he said to me, I don't know what to do because I feel like I need to respond to this. So being a playwright, I said, you should respond to this, and we will produce it in March.
Wow.
So he was struggling with the piece, tried to write it in the present tense, but it felt too on the nose. So he did what he did best. He went back to history. So he basically isolated the first slave rebellion.
Okay.
And basically that became how we saw, as a country, what race is all about and how racism, in a very strange way, began.
Huh.
Yeah. So we did the play. Yeah. And then, you know, it's complicated. The last part of the play is about fighting these English settlers, colonialists. And in the middle of that fight, towards the end of the play, we had a collage of all the African-American civil rights struggles, including bits from Ferguson.
Uh-huh.
And that same weekend, we had that wonderful incident where a policeman shot the young man with a taser gun.
And that
piece slid in there, too.
Okay.
And people were just completely upset, and they couldn't respond because it was just so present. And they came out of the theater saying things like, I need 15 minutes. I just can't breathe right now, which is kind of interesting. And some audiences are saying, must we see this again? I mean, are we done?
Huh.
I know I've seen this for 40 years. Why are we still seeing this?
Right.
So I think the impulses in all the audiences that we had for that particular run is indicative of, I think, our country's attitude and also our struggle.
Right.
I hope it's not hopelessness.
Yeah,
because I think in part it is.
Yeah.
You know, what can we do? I don't know what I can do if I were a person of color. I don't know what I can do if I'm a young white man. I don't know what I'm going to do because I've been here for so long and I'm older and white. I'm 70. I thought we fought for this.
Yeah.
So at least it's creating that dialogue. And what we learned is we need to figure out the step after the show to provide a safe platform for them to talk, for them also to figure out other resources they can reach out to.
Right, okay. So it's not just about talkbacks, but the talkbacks are part of it.
Yeah, well, we're learning this too. We realize talkbacks is not enough. We have to figure out what it really means. Do we give them, you know, 10 websites, 10 organizations?
Yeah.
You know, which is interesting because this has become an immersive theatrical experience for all of us.
Yeah, certainly. Do you feel like also, I wonder about a preparatory experience, whether, I mean, some people like to go in and not know anything about a play.
Yeah.
And I respect that. But, you know, if they're that kind of person, they're usually open to whatever play throws at them, usually.
Mm-hmm.
But people who want to have a more full experience, they want to read notes in the program or look online beforehand. Or I don't know if you've been to Kwame's Theater.
Mm-hmm.
The lobby has all that stuff. You can get there an hour early and, like, watch videos and do whatever you want.
We have a bit of that, but we don't do a lot of lobby displays. I think
what
we have is a lot of public programs. So basically, before a show sometimes, the context is very different. It's not a way to guide you into the play. So, for example, we're doing at Akhtar's play, The Who and the What right now.
Yeah, okay.
And it's about, you know, being Muslim, what's it like to be a woman, feminism. And then some of the groups that we reach out to would do new poetry about what's it to be a feminist in a different religion.
Okay.
So before the show begins, we'll have six, you know, artists spouting poetry, doing some conversation. So that contextualizes it, but not exactly what you're saying. It doesn't have that weigh in.
I mean, there's folks who want to read just the dramaturgy, like notes before a show, a specific show. And then there's ones that have an event that reflects on it or is related.
I kind of like what you just said. I'm the kind of audience member that says, I think my aunt is smart enough to not need to prep for this.
Right.
I want you to go in, but I want to figure out how to get your feedback, your reaction, and also what you think you want to do.
Yeah.
So I think the post-programming of a
play is important.
And we have tons of it. So our public programs, we have panels immediately after show.
Right. And you have different folks on them, and, you know, different from different civic organizations, experts.
From Latinos, from African-American. And we actually have a woman coming up next week. I forget her name, but she basically was on Facebook a few weeks ago for being denied a bottle of soda on the plane.
Oh, I think I heard, yeah.
Yeah, she's at Moth, but she's going to come speak to us on a panel as well. So
and
we
why, because she was black? No.
Or just... No, because she was Muslim.
Oh.
Because they thought that she could use it as a weapon. And she was so humiliated. She's a professor.
Yeah, that's crazy.
United Airlines.
United Airlines. That's good. Good to know. Good to know. There's practical things I don't... Remind me, Victory Gardens has two spaces. Is that right? Or no, just one?
We have one space, but we have two theaters.
Two theaters, that's what I mean.
A small and a larger one.
And one, right? One upstairs, like an attic or something?
Yeah, it's like a 109. It's an old movie theater, so they kind of like halved it.
Okay.
Know? Yeah.
So the ceiling's a little lower than it used to be. But there's
a little lower, right. And then we also have a rehearsal room that for the last 2 years we've been converting it into a 60-seat black box space for our resident companies to use as well.
And so how many seats is the big theater?
The big theater's about 300, but in the last season we halved it to, more than half, we brought it down to 260.
Okay.
And I want to probably bring it down just a little bit more because I feel like we need to be more intimate in that space.
All right.
Yeah.
And the shows have been doing well? I mean,
they've been good. I think I inherited a theater that traditionally never had big audiences. Mm-hmm. So the thing that we're finding right now is that people don't know a lot about us, which is interesting. And we just did this fact-finding mission. So our next year is about trying to get information out to the right people to gather them in. Chicago has 250 theaters.
Theaters.
It's a big old buffet table.
Yeah.
So I think to some extent we need to just make some more noise about what we are, that's all.
Ignition Festival goes on at Victory Gardens too, isn't
yes.
it? And you've continued that.
We've continued that. It used to be biannual.
Yeah, yeah.
This year we're doing it annually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I remember Chris Diaz's play came out of that, right?
Yes,
yeah,
it did.
Yeah.
So did Brendan Jenkins Appropriate as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's cool. When I talked to you and Emily a couple years ago, that was right when you started, right?
Yeah.
And the conceit was you're both playwrights who run theaters. And I want to just ask about you, selfishly, have you been able to continue writing and directing? Do you direct some of the shows?
Yes, I do. I direct a little bit more than I write. I think writing takes a lot more discipline, and I'm not very disciplined, I have to say.
Yeah.
I have two commissions that are outstanding, and I'm hoping to actually do some of it actually this trip round.
On this trip?
This next few.
Are you in Cleveland?
No. Actually, well, I'm in Sundance.
Sundance.
I'm going to be doing someone else's project, but it'll give me enough space to do some writing on my own, right?
Okay. I just wondered.
I think it's hard. You know, the only way to be a playwright and run a theater is that you have to be very disciplined about when you write.
Yeah.
And I think if you spend 4 hours a day writing at some early part of the day or the later part of the day, it's great. But also being an artistic director, I have to say that the job is 24/7.
Yeah.
I go to bed thinking about what we didn't do, what we have to do, and what was great, and I wake up with the same questions.
Yeah.
It's like living with a play. So I think it can be done.
Yeah.
I just think it takes incredible discipline or a staff that's able to let you do the things that you need to do.
Yeah.
We're a small theater company, so which I do love because we're nimble
and
I can do a lot more things.
Right.
And I think in a bigger theater company, being a playwright may be a little easier because you would have the support that you...
Sure.
Yeah.
It runs through a regular season or the off season right now, so you get some time to...
We have regular season in the summer. We have, you know, our Ignition Festival.
Which is... Takes your full attention as well.
Takes my full attention as well. It's good. I'm not complaining. I make sure that I take a holiday, but meanwhile, it runs. You know,
yeah,
it's exciting, and I do like empowering a group of young Americans whom I can safely say will be the next generation of leaders.
Right.
So that's been great.
That's an addition. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's in the coming season that you're especially excited about that you've programmed? I know this is all your babies, so you can't pick a favorite, but.
The one that I'm always excited about is the one that I'm working on, and it's actually the world premiere of Lucas Nath's Hillary and Clinton, given the fact that it's happening when she's actually running for president. What's really tricky is that because Lucas doesn't write biopics, you know.
Biopics.
They're not that kind of stuff that we do.
Yeah.
He does. So we're trying to figure out what it means to give it some distance.
Right.
And it takes place in her New Hampshire primary back in, 2008,
I believe. Yeah, before...
Yeah. So far, we've been trying to do it with a Latino cast, because okay. which is very interesting, too, because it provides you with that Brechtian distancing situation.
Sure, sure.
That actually gets you away from me, but yet closer. So we're heading towards that, and Lucas and I are just looking at trying to figure out what the Latino cast is.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love that play because it's one of his earlier plays that he could never get done. I don't know why, but it's a beautiful play about what it's like to be a woman of a certain age and wanting to do this beautiful thing. And it's hard because you're under your husband's shadow, and this is the man you love dearly who is very flawed.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's surrounded by men who are in her way.
Yeah. And are you directing it?
I'll be directing it.
And that's in the fall?
That's actually in April, May of...
Of next year, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
2016.
So did you like King and I?
I love the pomp and circumstance of it. And I also love what Bart did. I love the whole thing. I love the music.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I love aspects of it.
Yeah.
It could have been a little more, I think. And it's the writing, you know. I mean, it's what it was. It's colonial.
Yeah.
Do we really need a divorced British school teacher to come into a civilization older than Jesus to be taught lessons? I mean, that's the most colonial thing in the world.
Totally.
And, you know, you can teach me to, you know, sing a happy tune. Yeah. You can sing me Do-Re-Mi's, but what are you saying? And yet it's actually a very beautiful and difficult love story.
Yeah.
And yet they never really touch except for when they dance. Which is in and of itself repressed and beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. There could be layers of it, but it's just in the writing.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah, there's only so much you can do. Somehow South Pacific, especially that song Happy Talk, was somehow contextualized. I don't know if you saw that production as well.
Yes, I did.
The way he did Happy Talk felt Brechtian to me. He distanced it from the you know, fake Asian sound of it, right? Right. And, you know, I really thought that made the play, not just that number, but the whole production. And the way it handled the Cable and, I forget the name, Liat.
Yes.
Liat's relationship really sort of dealt with the fact that basically it's you know,
they're both outside. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, it's also, there's a very colonial, like, you know, sex tourist aspect to it, right?
Yes,
that's not pretty. But
that's a darker musical, though.
It is darker. Yeah. It's darker. Yeah, and that's what's weird is that King and I is dealing with big issues, but in sort of a very
it's oriental
storybook way.
No, it's oriental. It's very, you know, you come to my world, and and the entree in is an English woman.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally.
You know. Is not also an English woman without a child. So once you give her a child, she is pomp, circumstance, and pious.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If she is a single white woman running around in Asia, now that's another musical.
Yeah, that's what I want to see.
Right? One Night in Bangkok.
you have a home in Chicago and also in New York?
I still have my place in New York. I kept it there.
Right, right, right.
So it's kind of great to go back once in a while and have meetings.
Well, let me ask you this. I think Chicago as a city, I think we talked about it before, but do you feel embraced, and also do you want to embrace it? Do you like the city?
I'm embracing it, and I think the city embraces me.
Right,
I just think it's always going to be a little bit of my being the outsider, and I've learned to accept it, and actually I've grown to love my role. It just reminded me of when I first came to this country. I'm able to see it objectively. I also am able to love it objectively, but yet I can also criticize it very specifically.
Yeah.
So then
my
question is, if I'm able to see all these flaws, how am I going to address that, and what plays am I going to put on? So I'm able to celebrate it, but I'm not going to just say, let's have a parade.
Yeah,
let's actually talk
about
something that's systemic.
Right.
What's going on with our public schools? What's going on with your closing all these schools? What's going on with the black
Chicago
community?
Yeah, specifically.
You know,
we
bitch and moan and say we don't want Spike Lee to do this movie about Chirac, but it's a reality.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, it's a PR thing for some people.
Yeah.
But young black men are dying, and we're doing nothing. And yet we're more police. Does it really help?
Yeah. What's the Spike Lee? He's doing? He wants to do a film about what?
Chicago. It's called Chirac.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's a term that has always been used. When I was doing Luis Alfaro's Oedipus El Rey about gang violence, we gave out a statistic. More people, that specific time in the year that we did Oedipus, more people died in Chicago's
Chicago
than in Afghanistan.
Huh. it's always brought up with the mass killings when a bunch of white kids are killed in a school. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrible thing. And then people talk about this happening every week in Chicago, you know.
And that's like L.A. too, you know. I'm telling people, yeah, you think it's going to just disappear because they're like another country far away.
Yeah.
All it takes is something before they realize your neighborhood is nicer than mine. Why am I burning mine down?
Yeah, yeah.
And the bullet doesn't know a zip code.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just fly through. Just watch. Right. And it's slowly happening.
Yeah.
So.
On that happy note, do you
do I do musicals?
Do you ever miss L.A., Jay?
I do and I don't.
You've been there for a long time.
Yeah, right? I did because the Taper was an artistic home. And because of that and also a lot of other theater companies, we did a lot more new work and it was very exciting.
Yeah.
And I felt like once I wasn't there, the only things I probably do miss once in a while are some old friends.
Yeah, you know, yeah,
still work in the theater and food.
Will you ever do a musical at Victor Gardens?
We will.
Yeah?
Actually, we're looking at some.
Okay.
Yeah. I love new musicals.
You know, Lucas is working on some. So.
Yes, I know he is.
So, Che, thanks for talking
to
us.
Thank you, Rob.
All right. Take care.
And we're back with some recommendations of things we've seen, read, thought that you should know about. Deep, why don't you start?
Sure. I don't think we've ever recommended theaters produce a particular work, but in particular, Woolly Mammoth. If anyone, Woolly Mammoth, is listening to this podcast, you should produce ZM by Greg Kotas and Mark Holman. I think it would be right up your alley.
You think because they did the Robert Harris zombie play?
Yeah, and also, and they also do irreverent, you know, fun, borderline uncomfortable shows. If anyone has produced Urine Town, they should produce ZM.
Right,
because
right. I don't think a new Greg Kotas musical will go starving for places to be produced, but that's a good recommendation.
And yesterday I got the Hirschfeld Century. I took it from Rob's desk.
Uh-huh.
And
it's a book, right?
Yes, it's a book. It's a compendium of Al Hirschfeld's drawings. Mm-hmm. More than 360 drawings from, like, his entire career.
You go almost one a day
per year. Exactly, exactly. And I was telling Allison that the only thing missing from this book is, like, a full-length poster of an Al Hirschfeld drawing. And it's a beautiful coffee table book. The cover is one of Al Hirschfeld's self-portrait. And it's edited and with text by David Leopold. I haven't read it yet, but just flipping through it and seeing drawings I haven't seen before. It's not just theater drawings. It's also drawings of just celebrities and musicians. There's a really wonderful one in here of Aerosmith.
Wow.
And you can tell which one's Steve Tyler.
Of course.
Well, they're like born to be caricature. That's amazing.
I know. And oh my goodness. And I posted the shot of Sunday in the Park with George with the entire cast. And poor Bernadette Peters, the way he draws her. And her face is like half a chin. Horrible, but beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, we had a piece with this exhibit. Now, is it New York Historical Society or I forget where
it is? Yeah, it's in New York somewhere.
It's a new exhibit of his work, and we wrote a piece about that. And I didn't realize where he'd been inspired by a trip to Bali, where the art there, or that wasn't even the art. It was the bleached out colors because of the sunshine. Anyway, that inspired his sort of monochrome. Drawing style. I didn't realize that.
So, well, he also did color as well.
He did do color, but he was known really for just being able to sketch black and white, pen and ink. Anyway.
No, my next goal right now is to find like an Al Hirschfeld color poster and put it on my wall at home.
Well, don't, if you could please keep that book around the office or read it here so we can all dip into it. Is that all right, Dave?
Fine. Okay. Good thing I live in a New York apartment, so I don't have any space for things anyway.
Exactly. No, I don't either.
Yeah, so, and the exhibit's at the New York Historical Society.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, to October, so go there.
Or get the book. And Allison, recommendation from you?
Yeah, I have a play that I saw at the Contemporary American Theater Festival that kind of sticks out. It's On Clover Road by Stephen Dietz.
Okay.
It's a thriller, which I really just hadn't seen anything like this on stage before. It's this thriller about a mother who hires a private investigator to lure her daughter back from a cult.
Wow.
And it was just fascinating the way it was set up like a thriller movie. You know, everyone's on the edge of their seats and you could hear everybody audibly gasping at what's going to happen next. And yeah, I would say if you're going to make it down to Shepherdstown to see that, Lee Sellers played the lead role, and he's a favorite among the community down there, and he's returned quite a few times, and the actress Tasha Lawrence was really fantastic in it. So
is that going on for a while, or is it over now?
It goes on until the first weekend in August.
Oh, really? I didn't realize it kept going on. That's great. And mm-hmm. So and obviously we'll look for that if it gets picked up. I wish there were more thriller plays, actually. I can't honestly remember...
Beth Henley.
The last play.
The Jacksonian Beth Henley.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a thriller insofar as someone dies in the first act. And you
yeah,
have to
I didn't... I mean, but that... Did, I'm just...
Went.
I'm thinking of, like, you know, I that was an interesting play, and it was shocking and had a lot of emotions in it. But just the genre piece in which there's actual suspense, or let alone a gasp, you know. I don't remember the last play, except for plays that, like, have extreme violence in them or blood where people, like, that gives a visceral reaction. But ones that are mm-hmm. thrillers, I just think, I'm saying more straight thrillers, bring them on. I know I just did an interview with Darko Trezniak. Hartford Stage is going to do Rear Window on stage, which is based on the Cornell Woolrich short story, not the Hitchcock movie. Apparently there's no Grace Kelly in this version, which is a big deficit. But in any case, it sounds like it's a good thriller, a stage thriller. I would just like to recommend another podcast, which I've just started to dip into. Haven't listened to the whole first episode yet. I think it's actually the second episode. It's called Subtext. It's on the LA Stage Alliance has rebooted their online magazine or presence with a site called At This Stage, but the at is sort of the at symbol. So you just go to This Stage. Look for that. And the podcast is called Subtext. It's done by Brian James Polak, who's the, I think he's a literary manager and press person at Boston Court Theater in Los Angeles. And he's the host. And this week he's got the Kilroys, two of the Kilroys, Joy Meads and Meg Morashnik, talking about their work. But what's great about the podcast so far is that Brian starts off with his own sort of monologue about his own. He's a playwright himself. And he just starts it, and it's got the collegial sort of back and forth talking like we do on our podcast, but it's also got the sort of monologue. I wouldn't compare it to Marc Maron necessarily, but it is just Brian talking about his life and his work, and making links between his life and his work and the many plays that he's seen and loved. So it's a fascinating. It kind of lives up to the title. It's called Subtext: The Things That We Don't Usually Talk About. So I recommend that highly. I think with that, we'll close another exciting edition of Off Script. Sorry about the delay. We'll get back on schedule now that Deep is back.
All right. See you next week, folks.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye.